Okay, thanks for the introduction, and hello everyone. First, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give a talk here at this workshop. Yeah, and so I'm going today to talk about a more advanced topic, like it's considered to be more advanced, as Miles said, because it's there are some technological. So you'll see in the talk. The topic is continuous matrix product states and how to solve quantum field theories, non-relativistic quantum field theories with continuous matrix product state. And this is work in collaboration with Julian Rincon and Gifre Vidal, who are both here at the Perimeter Institute. Okay, so is this working? Not quite. Oh, no, it is. Maybe I have to go closer to the antenna. Okay, so how can we solve quantum field theories? That's the topic of my talk. So as Miles has already pointed out, quantum field theories are fundamental in physics. They appear at all kinds of, all kinds of problems, for example, in condensed matter physics and also in high energy physics. And it's there has been a great effort has been devoted to coming up with methods to solve quantum field theories. And I've just listed some very, some exemplary ways to actually solve quantum field theories on this slide. And if you have a quantum field theory and you're lucky and the thing you're interested in is actually a free theory, there are ways to solve it is just by Fourier transformation. The example that I'm showing here is a massive Klein-Gordon theory. So that's pretty nice. You can solve it. You can actually try to understand the physics from it. But the problem with this is, of course, that most of the theories we're interested in are interacting and not free. And ways to treat these interactions, there's various ways to treat the interactions, and one very common approach that has been used over decades in the past is by perturbation theory, which is one, for example, this boils down to computing sums of Feynman diagrams. And this has been very successful, and it's, applicable in many situations. In other cases, you might actually be very lucky, and the model you're interested in is integrable, and you could solve it exactly, and an example for this would be certain quantum field theories in 1+1 dimension, and I'm going to show you one later, so that I'm going to repeatedly show this a particular example that can be solved by so-called beta ansatz. But in the generic situation, the generic situation for a strongly interacting QFT, which is when is basically means that none of these approaches is applicable, and then you're stuck with, there are two very common approaches to solve this problem in this case, which is the things that Miles has talked about today, and Steve has talked about it, and which is you take your field theory and put it on a lattice, and then you apply, for example, quantum Monte Carlo or tensor network methods to apply to calculate ground states or excited states or whatever you're interested in. And the other approach that I'm going to talk about today is to use tensor networks directly in the continuum, so-called continuous matrix product states, to calculate ground states. Not in a non-perturbative fashion. okay. Sorry, I think the battery is pretty empty. Okay, so here is a short summary of this talk. This is a two-slide summary, and the main point that I want to make in this talk is that continuous tensor networks can be used efficiently to calculate or to solve interacting quantum field theories in 1+1 dimension. And I will show you some, throughout this talk, I will show you results, or I always refer to one particular example of a quantum field theory in 1+1 dimension, which is the so-called Liebig-Linegar model, which is a model of interacting bosons. And this is the interaction part. And yeah, there's kinetic energy and potential energy. And this is a very nice model because it can also be solved exactly, so we can compare our results to analytic results. And so what quantities can we calculate with these continuous matrix product states? Maybe I'll just go like this. we can calculate, for example, local observables, for example, ground state energy densities of quantum field theories. So this plot here shows you the ground state energy density as a function of interaction strength for this Liebig-Linegar model. And the blue line is, for example, in this case, is the analytic result that is obtained from beta ansatz. And I compare this to numerical results. The dots here are the numerical result from a CMPS calculation directly in the continuum. And you get a very good agreement over a very wide parameter range. Okay, other things you can calculate are, for example, correlation functions. So this thing here is a psi dagger psi, a particle correlation function for the ground state of this model as a function of space here. So this is a log-log plot. And these are different interaction strengths. This is weak, this is strong. And for example, in this case, what we get here, you see that this model is equal to 1 CFT, so it is is critical. And we get a power law decay in all these correlation functions. And the power law in this case depends on, like, the exponent, exactly, exponent depends on G. It's basically given by the Luttinger parameter. Other quantities we can calculate are density-density correlation functions. This is, again, for this model, and for increasing interaction, this is weak interaction, and these are successive, like, progressively stronger interactions. And this is, for example, and what you can see here is that if you increase the interaction strength, you actually can get this electron. Like, this system fermionizes for very strong interactions because the bosons try to avoid each other. So in the limit of infinite interactions, the spectrum of this Hamiltonian actually is the same one as that of for free fermions. And what you can see here is that the bosons are trying to avoid each other, which would be this electron cusp that Steve was talking about earlier today. Okay, so what quantum field theories can we now solve? Can we solve all of them, or in 1D, or are there any restrictions? And the short answer is yes, there are restrictions. For non-relativistic models, and by non-relativistic I mean a kinetic energy that looks like this, it's a product of two derivatives, the method usually works fine, so there are no problems. Like, there are restrictions as to how the interaction might look like, but, you know, it usually works very well. For relativistic theories, like, for example, the Klein-Gordon model we had before, things look a little bit different. So there we need a UV regularization to make it amenable for treatment with CMPS. And the reason is basically that the kinetic energy is not positive definite in this case. Okay, so, and I'll switch into the first part of my talk, which will be a soft introduction to the field of continuous matrix product states. And you've already heard a lot about MPS, and in particular in Ash's talk, he has already mentioned all these diagrams. So I'll just give you a short summary of notation that I'm using in this talk. So this here is an MPS weight function that is parameterized by tensors A, 1 to AN, where this thing is living on a ring, for example, of n sites, and at each site of that ring, you could have a spin. And there is a drawing that represents this wave function here, namely this thing here, where each of these circles is just an MPS tensor. So this is an MPS tensor at site n. It has matrix indices, and it has so-called physical indices. In this case, it could, for example, be the spin state at the given site. And so this is how you write this. So this is this object here. And I will frequently use a notation that's not quite standard. I will rearrange this guy into a vectorized form where each of these one, A0, is now a matrix that corresponds what has the index 0 here. A1 is a matrix is the matrix with the index 1 here, and so on and so forth, like depending on how many you have at each site. Okay. Oh, now it works. Okay, so here's a short outline of my talk. So in the previous talks, you heard a lot about how to discretize quantum field theories and use lattice MPS techniques to tackle the problem there. And basically, it boils down, you discretize the theory, and then you have matrix. You have the machinery of the Emergian matrix product states available to you. There are lots of very powerful and efficient methods, like the Emergy, TBD, TDBP. There's lots of more for latter acronyms. Or actually, these are the only one I could think of. And in any case, you will usually be very happy about this situation because it all works well and it's well established. And today I'm going to talk a little about a slightly different approach, namely, how can we now, is there a way of taking this limit exactly? So this is what I'm going to talk about today, which can we exactly take the continuous limit with an MPS, with a matrix product state? And this is work that is based on this paper, 2010. Is it 2010? I think it is. By Frank Verstraete and Ignacio Sirac. And in this talk, I hope I will be able to explain to you how this state here makes a transition into a thing that lives in the continuum. So this will be the analog of a lattice MPS in the continuum, where instead of having tensors at each lattice site, now you have a tensor density where at each point in space you have tensors. And I will talk a little bit about how these powerful lattice techniques that we have translate into continuum. And just a small, so usually it's not that simple. In many cases, you will get headaches if you try to make something work. But in other, like there is a significant number of cases where you can actually make good progress. Okay. So what's a good way of understanding what a CMPS is? For me, it was by constructive approach. I mean, you start with a bosonic lattice MPS, and then you try to make that on a lattice, so you have a lattice of n sites, and then you try to make that bosonic lattice MPS, put it onto finer and finer grids. So, okay, so let's look at what I mean by this. Let's start with a state on a lattice of n sites, that is a bosonic lattice MPS. So zero is the vacuum at every site, which means having no particle there. These Bs here are bosonic creation operators, the B daggers at every site, and the As here are your MPS tensors. So now, so here are some exemplary parts of the wave function. So for example, one part that is very important later is the vacuum. So how does the vacuum amplitude of this guy look like? Well, it's just the A0 is for a five-side lattice, for example, it's just A0, 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 which would correspond to having no particle in the system. Right? So it means A0, this A0 here, of course, is the matrix that comes with the empty state. What about one particle states? Like one particle states have amplitudes of this form, where you have A0s everywhere except at one site. In this case, at site 3. And in the site 3, this would correspond to having one particle at site 3. And there's many more. Of course, two particle, three particle, but I think this is enough to understand the principle. So how can we construct a continuum limit from this state? So, well, I'll start with a system of length L. So we have an interval that starts at 0 and ends at L. And we discretize it into three sites, like 1, 2, 3. And they're separated by distance L half. And on that thing, on this discretized system, we now put a very particular MPS, like MPS matrices here, here, and here, of a very particular form, namely what you can see here in this upper corner. Okay. So how do they look like? So the A0 looks like this. It's identity plus this epsilon times a matrix Q. And I've written it down here in larger so that it can actually read it. And this would correspond to having the vacuum. There is the matrix A1, which corresponds to having one particle there, is the square root of this epsilon times another matrix R. And then there are higher occupations. And they're all given by higher powers of R. So I'm not going to explain why they look like they look, but you can ask me after the talk. So the variational parameters of that state are now given by matrices Q and R. This is all you need, two matrices that determine the state of that lattice, bosonic lattice MPS. So now we can go ahead and make this lattice finer. So we just insert two new sites in between the old ones. This is now a five lattice site. And we put the same state here, almost the same state, with the same matrices Q and R. The only difference is we change the epsilon, right? So here you had epsilon equal to L half. Here you have epsilon equal to L quarter. And we do this again. We insert new sites in between. So we go from 5 to 9. And we can, so we can just proceed all the way down to the continuum. And we will, by inserting more and more tensors, and we will end up with an expression like this, which is basically a continuum of tensors at every point in space. And this has a very elegant, we can write this down elegantly as this expression here. So this is a path-ordered exponential of these variational parameters Q and R that act on the vacuum state zero. So this thing acts on the vacuum state zero. And what you see here is that the Q is this that comes with an identity that parameterizes how the vacuum acts in some sense. And this R here comes with a psi dagger in the exponent. So this is related to putting particles into your system, into your state. So you might ask, is this trivial? Because what happens if you put epsilon to zero, this becomes one, and everything else is zero. So you might ask, is there anything happening? And the short answer is yes. Just the same way that this thing here becomes in the limit epsilon to zero, the exponential function and not something trivial, in the same way, the CMPS becomes something non-trivial because the matrices, as you make epsilon smaller and smaller, each individual matrix becomes more and more trivial, but you put more and more of them, so that the product of something almost trivial to a high power is, of course, non-trivial. Well, not of course, but in this case, it's non-trivial. And the construction of this state is such that you have, for example, finite particle density in the continuum limit, finite energy density, you know, like it's well-behaved in this continuum limit. So one question is now, can we do calculations with this? I mean, it's a nice construction, but how can we actually calculate things with it? And I think it's a good example of how we actually do it is by considering how the norm of a state would be calculated in the continuum limit. And just by the same construction we had before, we start with a lattice of n sites. The norm of that, of such a state on n sites, is just given by this expression. So it looks like this, and you can contract it, and you will end up with an expression that looks like this. It's some operator to the power of n, and the trace over that operator, where this operator here is called MPS transfer operator, and it's just given by a contraction of MPS tensors. And you know, we do the same construction as before. We insert more sites. We go from n to 2n. The norm now, the only difference here is that this operator is now raised to the power of 2n. And if we go all the way down to the continuum, we'll end up with an expression that looks looks like this. What you see here, this is an exponent of L. That's the system size times an operator T. And that operator T is defined by your MPS, your CMPS tensors Q and R. And you could think, so this T is it's the generator of the MPS transfer operator. That's how you can think of it. Can we calculate other observables with this approach? Yes. For example, density-density correlation functions or particle correlation functions, psi dagger psi. There are some complications at the boundaries here that I'm not going to explain. The basic principle, the basic point here is that the same technology can be applied to efficiently calculate such observables. And that means we can actually efficiently calculate energy densities for quantum field theories, like, for example, the Liebig-Linear model. And this is the basis for the numerical optimization techniques I'm going to explain later in this talk. So why CMPS? You might ask. We have all these lattice technologies, so why do we need it? So there are some good reasons. One reason I think is, for me, it's just interesting, is that CMPS is a class of variational many-body states directly in the continuum. So you never make any reference to a discretization or anything. It works directly in the continuum. So this is very interesting. And what are the alternatives to this approach? Well, we already heard Miles and Steve talk about, for example, discretizations. For example, for the Liebig-Linear model, the thing that I showed you before, you can go ahead and take your Hamiltonian and put it on a lattice with a lattice spacing delta x, and you will end up with an expression like this here. So Miles already, Miles already made all the points that I wanted to make in my talk. So you see that there is a separation of energy scales. This is much more singular than this, and this is much more singular than this. So what does this mean for the DMRG optimization? Well, you can you can compare this to like a hike in the Alps. If you are, let's suppose you're hiking in the Alps, and this is you, and you're very tired, and you would like to go here to get some drink or whatever. So the problem what DMRG is usually doing, it's trying to minimize the energy by local moves. So you look locally and say, oh, let's go in this direction. Then you go, and then you see, oh yeah, energy is smaller, let's go in this direction. So you sort of move around locally. So if you try to do that with such a Hamiltonian, the problem is that the energy landscape looks pretty terrible. Namely, there are these hills here are of the order 1/(Δx²). So if you just stand there and you say, and someone tells you, yeah, I have to go in this direction, and you go a little bit too far, you will end up like super high in a mountain. And that makes this energy optimization quite sensitive to like very small moves, right? So the basic point is that the limit of delta x to zero, really to zero, is not possible with this numerical approach. But what people usually do is this so-called finite delta x scaling. And I'll show you a plot later how that looks. Another good reason why do you use CMPS is, we have evidence that if you do DMRG, for example, for this lattice Hamiltonian I showed you before, the discretized Lieb-linear model. If you do DMRG for it, we have evidence that the matrices actually want to become CMPS matrices secretly, right? So, but what does this mean? Like DMRG doesn't have any idea about this structure. What DMRG is basically doing is optimizing matrices A0, A1, A2, and so forth. But secretly, these want to become this, want to look like this. So in the DMRG, we actually are using a lot of power or investing a lot of computational time into reproducing the fact that this state here has an identity here and is plus and is only a very small, there's only a very small correction to it, right?
And what's epsilon here? Is delta X?
Yeah, So epsilon is delta X here. It should be the lattice spacing. So DMRG is blind to this thing here. So it's just trying to optimize. And whereas it might actually be much, much more efficient if you could use all the power you have to optimize the variational parameters that are actually there instead of, you know, trying to optimize some sort of weird combination of all of them. Oh, sorry. So here is an example of how this would, like, how DMRG would treat, for example, the Lieb-linear model. So this is the lattice spacing, and this is ground state energy of the corresponding Hamiltonian with a given lattice spacing. And so these blue dots here are different DMRG calculations. And what you see is that, well, you see there is a very nice scaling. And in this case, you could just put a straight line through, and you will get some ground state energy density at zero lattice spacing around here. The point here is that this looks very nice, but the thing is that all these calculations that you do here become progressively harder because the lattice spacing becomes much smaller. So this here, for example, is more expensive than this one. This is more expensive than this one. I mean, there are very smart ways of making good initial states for finer lattice spacing. That, you know, initialize finer lattices by coarser ground states from the coarser ones, but it's not very straightforward to do it. And the point I want to make is, with, for example, a CMPS calculation, you would do a single shot calculation and directly get the continuum energy with one calculation. Okay, so that finishes my introduction. Are there any questions at this point? No? Okay. Okay, so the second part of my talk will be about variational optimization techniques for CMPS. So this is some work that has been recently published on the archive. What I'm going to talk about now is how can we obtain actually CMPS ground states for quantum field theories in plus 1D. And one approach that has already pretty early after the initial proposal of CMP has been put forward is by imaginary time evolution. And the basic principle is quite simple. You take some initial CMPS and you just hit it with a Hamel, like the, with this operator here, and print by, you evolve it in imaginary time, and you hopefully at some point you will end up with a state that is very close to the ground state of your Hamiltonian. But I'm going to talk about something else, a little bit different approach today, namely about how to directly minimize the energy. So I told you earlier that with the CMPS, you can actually calculate the expectation value of the energy of the state of a CMPS. So this would be a CMPS, this would be a quantum field theory, and you can efficiently calculate this guy. And the variational parameters of your state are the matrices Q and R. So the idea is to use this thing here to optimize the current matrices Q and R, and the way this optimization proceeds is by so-called simple gradient optimization. It means you use the gradient as a function of Q and R of your variational parameters of this expression to lower the energy. So you are the given initial state, you calculate the gradient, and you walk a little bit into the gradient direction, and you see, energy is lower. Okay. And you keep on doing that until you converge. So the principle is very simple. You start with some CMPS matrices, you calculate the gradient, you add a little bit of the gradient to your current state, and you measure the convergence by looking at the norm of the gradient. How does it look in a little bit more detail? So let's see how that works for one step. Okay, so you're given some initial state in a CMPS form, which means you have matrices Q and matrices R here. And Now you do a so-called regauging. Nothing has happened to the state here. This is just a reparameterization of your state. It's not really, this is a technical detail, and for the experts, the reason why you do this is because the orthogonal, like the scalar product or the metric, the local metric of that, for example, of these matrices here becomes the identity in that gauge. And that is very nice, has some nice properties. Anyway, you put it into that state. So what I've introduced here, what has happened here? So I've introduced matrices lambda here and here, lambda and lambda inverse here and here. And the Qs and the Rs have acquired a subscript C here, right? So these QCs are now your new variational parameters. And you calculate the gradient with respect to them. And then you update. So calculate the gradient, you add a little bit, and you end up with new matrices that Q tilde and R tilde, they are red now, so they're different. And now you reabsorb the lambda. So these lambdas, oh, sorry, I didn't tell you these lambdas are diagonal matrices that contain the Schmidt values of a bipartition of that state. Now you reabsorb these lambdas, and you will end up with a new state that has the same form as the old one. The only difference is that the matrices are updated and the energy will be a little bit lower. I haven't told you actually how to calculate the gradient, right? And I'm not going to do that in any detail. Earlier today, you already saw how you can calculate these gradients for lattice systems. And the main point I want to make here is that for the continuous system, it's very similar. You can think of the gradient with respect to your QC and RC as looking like this. So here you have your CMPS tensor. Here you have CMPS. Here you have another CMPS. In between, you have an object that is related to the Hamiltonian. This gradient can just be calculated by contracting this object here. The main difference to the thing that we saw in the morning is that this thing here now is an infinitesimal layer as compared to the lattice case, where this was corresponding to a layer per lattice site that you were adding. There are ways of calculating this. All right, so the benchmark model that I've been using, I'll show you now some results for a benchmark model that we've been calculating, which is this Liebig-Linegar model for bosons. So you have...
Sorry, Martin, before you drew that nice mountain, you wanted to walk to... So why don't you draw the same now and say, hey, this is not going to work?
So the point is that you're using a parameterization. So you are optimizing the variational class that you're using is designed to avoid this problem. So if you're using the CMPS in this way, these mountains they're gone. There is no mountain anymore. It's like a transformation. You're flattening all this. It's like you're flattening this out and the landscape has become flat. Like, it's not totally flat, but it's much flatter than it was before.
Can you say intuition as to why that's true? Like what is the thing which...
So the main, I can give you a good intuition is if you look at the Hamiltonian I showed you before, it had a 1 over delta x squared in it, right? So if you use this particular form of the MPS that I was showing you earlier,
So the question is, why are secretly the epsilons or something? Why
There are epsilons here, the states here. So the CMPS has epsilons here, right? And or delta x's. And in the Hamiltonian has 1 over delta x's at some places. And this, the way, you, because you chose, the, this form has been chosen in a very careful way such that you will get cancellations of all these epsilons. So it means that for any epsilon you put, the state will have a finite energy density. So there's these cancellations, everything cancels out exactly.
How exactly is this UV regular?
This is UV.
That's so, where the jumps come from. Right?
Sorry?
That's where the mountains come from, right? From the fact that there's a UV regularization from your lattice.
Yes.
Your lattice.
I mean, this means you're UV regularizing. But the point is the Hamiltonian was UV regularized in the first place because it was a non-relativistic Hamiltonian. So there is a UV, this state is still UV regularized, so because there's nothing happening in very short distances, it basically means you have a finite particle density, which in other terms, it means that these matrices here have a finite norm. They're not going crazy. So there is an inherent UV regularization in this approach. If you demand that the matrices here are, you know, not very crazy or they have they're well behaved, they have finite norm, for example. Okay.
Is there ever any advantage to put in the R squared term and then somehow use it? Is it ever aided with
this one?
Practical calculations?
For, it depends. So for the single boson cases, no. But if you consider more species, then you have to be very careful about, I mean, it matters, yes. Any questions? Okay. Was this then? Okay. Okay, so yeah, the Liebling-Nigger model. So the main point is you can solve it by beta ansatz. Okay, so now I'll show you some results for how this optimization that I was mentioning before actually works. So here I will, so if you look at this plot here, this shows you as a function of iteration number of your optimization, it shows you the current ground state energy or the current energy density of that state. And blue dots here are the results obtained with this gradient optimization approach. And we compare this to the imaginary time evolution, which works like this, I've explained to you before. And for the same step sizes that we are taking, we see that this gradient optimization like converges quite a bit faster than the green crosses here, which is the imaginary time evolution. And the same is true, for example, for particle densities. If you look at how the particle density converges, you will see that the gradient optimization converges quite a bit faster than the imaginary time evolution. And well, what does this allow us? It means that because it's converging much faster, we can actually go to much larger bond dimensions than we would be able to do with imaginary time evolution in this case. The fact that imaginary like things like this converge much faster than time evolution is well known from lattice MPS calculations, right? So it's not a surprise that it's faster. But it's nice, actually. So this plot here shows you, again, as a function of iteration number, how the current energy density of the state converges to the exact energy density for the given, as given by the beta ansatz. So you see that this converges roughly on a factor of 100 faster for this, in this case, than imaginary time. Okay, so now let me quickly tell you a little bit about the role of initialization for these calculations. So what does this plot show you? This is as a function of iteration number, I show you how imaginary time evolution converges. So this here is, in some sense, for the imaginary time evolution, you can calculate something like a gradient norm. You can calculate how good the state is converged, and this is for and I show as a function of iteration number how good the state of this imaginary time evolution is converged for different bond dimensions. For example, for bond dimension 8, you see that it converges quite fast. And slightly larger bond dimension 64, it still converges monotonously, a little bit slower. But if you go to larger and larger bond dimensions, you see that, this is for random initial states, right? I'm choosing random initial states. So for large bond dimension, random initial state, you see that this energy, the convergence of the imaginary time evolution, you know, looks a little bit weird. It might drop fast, so this is something that typically happens. It develops a plateau, it starts to increase, and then there will be a peak, it will go down, and then it usually converges monotonously, though a little bit slow in this case. So the same thing happens actually for gradient optimization. It might be a little bit less severe, but it still can happen. So one of the things that I want to, so one of the questions you can ask is, if I would be able to get a better initial state, might that improve my convergence? And the answer is yes. And in fact, what we have been doing is we have used DMRG, like regular lattice DMRG, to obtain initial states for CMPS optimization. The basic principle is you take your field theory and you discretize it, take it and put it on a very broad grid with a lattice spacing delta x, and then you run DMRG to obtain a ground state. And DMRG for large lattice spacings converges very fast and everything is nice. And then there is a way to take the state that you obtained from this DMRG calculation and translate it into a CMPS. Okay, so I'm not going to explain how that works, but you can do it. And then you take this state and put it as an initial state for your CMPS optimization, and that will give you a substantial speed up as compared to choosing initial states, random initial states. And this is what I want to show you here on this plot. So this is again iteration number, and this is like how good the state is converged for three different simulations. So the blue one is the imaginary time evolution simulation from before. And you see that it, you know, this typical behavior that I showed you before. This, the green one is this gradient optimization. And you see that even though it converges, it converges a bit faster than imaginary time evolution in this case, but you know, there is this, you see this plateau, and it takes quite a while to, you know, get over it and then converge there. Now, if you take a DMRG preconditioned initial state, you will see that the gradient optimization actually converges super fast. In this case, like 350 iterations as compared to roughly 3,000, in this case, as compared to roughly, or more than 30,000 in this case. Okay. And this is actually independent of bond dimension. All right. So now let me just quickly show you some more results. For example, what you can, another thing I, this is finite D artifacts for CMPS calculations. So here I show you correlation functions of the Liebling-Linger model for different bond dimensions. And what you see here, so this is small to large bond dimensions, and you see the typical behavior that we know from CMPS, from the lattice MPS. We see algebraic decay because it's a, this model is a CFT. We see algebraic decay, and that at some point turns the levels off into a constant. And this leveling off is a finite D artifact, finite bond dimension artifact of your MPS. And you can study how this actually converges with increasing bond dimension. Other artifacts are, for example, so this should go to zero, and we see that this actually goes to zero as a power law. So this is the residual value here. We can look at the entanglement entropy that should be infinite, and we can study how it actually diverges as a function of D. We can look at how the energy accuracy converges as a function of D. And this all looks very reassuring because you know this all from the CMPS. So this is, yeah.
If CMPS is a continuous version of MPS, then why don't your correlation functions go exponential?
So no, sorry, yeah. So I was not plotting the connected correlation function here. So you should actually, what you usually plot is the connected correlation function that goes to zero at some point, right? So this is only Seidegger psi. I should subtract something like mean of Seidegger times mean of psi.
So then
it will crash down to zero. So you can also do non-integrable integrable models, for example, by adding a pairing term. So the result would be this here, or this is a correlation function for a non-integrable model. This actually opens a gap. So in this case, it's actually much easier for the calculation is much simpler. You need only small bond dimensions. You can do long-range interactions where particles are interacting with each other when they're far apart. So these are, again, the results for the correlation function, Seidegger psi, or density for some value of interaction strength and range of the interaction. Okay, Al, and I think that's actually, I can conclude with this. Okay, so yeah, so I just talked a little bit about steepest descent, and we have evidence that it's actually much faster than regular imaginary time evolution, and it helps you to go to larger bond dimensions. You can actually include a nonlinear conjugate gradient, or you can improve this simple step that I've told you about by with a nonlinear conjugate gradient that gives you another speed up. Yeah, and DMRG can actually be used as a very good preconditioner for CMPS calculations. Yeah. All right, so that's it. Thanks.
Question for Martin?
Yeah, so can you talk a bit about one of the obstructions in going to relativistic systems? Or you know, you're saying
so the
issue about regularization.
Yeah, so the problem if you try to run this and you have no UV cutoff, what it's trying to do is the system tries to put in more and more particles into your system, and it will just diverge. In some sense, I mean, the problem is that the vacuum has fluctuations of all energy scales already present, right? And the optimization tries to get these. It tries to get the high energy fluctuations very well because they are very important. But this means that this means that you're basically wasting all the power you have on your high energy fluctuations, and the low energy behavior of your system is basically totally off. So you'll just get bad results.
So is there some way to?
Yeah. So there are the ways people. What you usually do, and so you two have, for example, they, and Frank has studied this. You can add You can break the Lorentz invariance. You can add something, you know, a certain term to the kinetic energy that stops your system. You know, so this is a way of UV regularizing. It's just,
sure.
Yeah.
Oops. I have a question.
Yeah.
So can you do this DMRP preconditioning in a sequence of steps? Because you know how to go to the continuum from DMRG. So
yeah, yeah.
You go back and you can put your space down.
You can actually.
The last thing.
Yes, you can actually do it. So the way we do it is exactly in this way. We start with a DMRG on a very coarse grid, and then, you know, you can take the state and do another DMRG. You translate the state from one lattice to another lattice to another lattice that is finer and finer. But at some point, you just say, well, now I just go all the way down to the continuum.
Right.
That's basically how you do it. Right. In most cases, it's actually enough to do one or two initializations.
Right.
So on a fixed lattice, we have a gap Hamiltonian, then we have this guarantee that MPS is good descriptions for the ground state.
Yes.
Does this translate to the continuous case?
Yes, it looks like. So there is. I'm not sure if there are any rigorous proofs actually for this. I don't know. I'm not aware.
Not for a relativistic.
Yeah.
I mean, none of this.
Yeah.
I have a slight comment on your Alps example. So
okay.
It strikes me that when you have these fine grids,
yeah,
it's like you have to drive slower.
That's
you don't
right.
Have
yeah.
To go over the mountain, so it's like the mountains are getting steeper and the road is narrow, so you have to drive slower and slower.
Yeah, exactly.
To
yeah.
Get to them, but you don't have to go over the mountains.
No, that's not right. But it's rather like if you're blind and someone tells you, oh, here's the direction you have to go, and you're just you take a giant step into that direction, you might actually end up being too high instead
right.
of.
Right. So you have to go slow.
Yeah, you have to go slow and do tiny steps. Basically,
yeah.
that's. But so this is what you see in the simulations. Everything becomes just much slower.
Sometimes in DMRG, when we're starting in totally the wrong state, and there really is a mountain to get to the next one, and
yeah.
You just can't get there. And we have to sort of guess to be closer to the right. Mountain.
Yes.
So yeah. What does this mean? Small steps in the
MRG. Yeah, that's right.
So you do a sweep, and you find that your state hasn't changed very much.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do more state, and you find after you do 100 sweeps, oh, now you've made some real progress.
Yeah.
But often in DMRG, we think a few sweeps.
But I think what it's also.
The algorithm goes automatically.
It just has to take small. It sort of has a step size built in. It goes as far as it can, and it can't go very far.
I think it basically boils down to what Miles was mentioning earlier. You just you reduce the accuracy in your solvers, and just say, "Well, I only want very inaccurate results," which means the solver will stop after a few iterations because it will say, "Oh, that's okay anyway." So, and then this is basically what it means to do a small step size there.
Well, it adjusts something very locally. It does a little thing locally, but it has to accumulate to a big, large change, and it can only do so much for it. Okay.
So related to this problem, so I asked him, yes, so what is well known is that if you plot the one particle expectation versus momentum, so n of k, the one body that is estimated of the expression of k,
mm-hmm.
then for any CMPS, this has to be k by one over k.
Yes.
And that's basically why this is automatically UV regularized for any one.
Yeah.
So what is the equivalent statement for the lattice? What is this one over k to the four?
Well, actually, I don't know.
To somehow these steps that we're just talking about.
Well, I guess it should look the same on a lattice. No, I mean there will be some because you have a UV. There will be some cutoff, right? Because you can't go to arbitrary high momentum in this case. It will just be like blop, and then there is nothing up above this sort of momentum. But up to that point, I guess. Yeah.
One of the things before is because of the fact that the Fourier transform of continuous direction is always.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
You mean something that you want to impose,
something that's
automatic? I mean, but I think, yeah. There's a problem, exactly. You know, the MPS approximation has the MPS state, so it doesn't impose anything on what you're
momentum density will look like. So anyway,
just okay. Yeah.
And what you actually need, I mean, to avoid these steep mountains as stages.
Yeah. Okay, I see that. Yeah. So for a generic MPS, this would look. I don't know how this would look like, but for the emerging ground state, it would probably look very similar, actually, to this k to the minus four decay up to some momentum cutoff.
Okay, let's thank Martin again.